Last week, we started a study about sorrow. Tears, crying, those bad times, those difficult times, the trying times. We left off, I believe, on page 44. We had some information about Paul, Romans chapter 10. We, as we look at him, find that there are some times where he was seriously disturbed about some situations. The book of Galatians comes to mind. Also, the book of Romans. In Romans 10, verse 2, he talked about some people who had a zeal for God. He said, though, it was not according to... Well, they had the zeal, but it wasn't consistent or according to knowledge. So they had a lot of interest, a lot of desire, but they weren't headed in the right way. They were not following the truth. And then in Romans 10:3, he said that their ignorance was to the point where they tried to establish their own righteousness, their own standard, and that, of course, would not have been right. And they did that rather than submit to God's righteousness. We also, I think, dealt with Romans 9, verse 2. Paul said he had a great heaviness, and there was continued sorrow in his heart because of his brethren. In fact, it was so bad, he said, I wish that I could be accursed, cut off from God, but that simply wasn't possible. So here you have a fellow, he's risked great things for the cause of Christ. He's been beaten at various times, he's weary, he's in a state of pain, hunger, thirst, he has anxiety from the congregations, the problems, 2 Corinthians 11:24 through 28. So he's going through some very difficult times, just as people today can. We talked about that some in our recent classes on elders. Let's get a couple of helpers lined up. The first one for Acts chapter 20, Acts 20 verse 19, and then we'll look at the book of Philippians, Philippians chapter 3 verses 17 through 19. Let's see a little bit more about Paul and some of the struggles he had. Acts chapter 20 verse 19, who wants to take responsibility for that? Lois. And then Philippians chapter 3 verses 17 through 19. You'll have a couple of minutes to get there. Philippians 3, 17 to 19, Betty. Julie, we'll ask you to pick up 2 Corinthians 11:26 in a little bit. Julie, 2 Corinthians 11, verse 26. But we began with Acts chapter 20, verse 19.
Serving the Lord with all humility and with tears and with trials which came upon me through the plots of the Jews.
Okay, let's fill in our blanks. Paul said he had served the Lord, served God with many tears, and there were also temptations, and these things resulted from who? Not the Gentiles, but the Jews. They were lying in wait and so forth. So when we look at people today, evil people, or maybe individuals who don't really perceive themselves to be evil, but they do evil things, sometimes it causes people to cry. That can happen with adults, but especially with young people. You, for example, if you have young kids or have had young kids, think about maybe between the ages of 5 and 12. How difficult is it for kids during that time of life to shed tears? All right, I mean, it's almost like the drop that he was mean to me, she was mean to me. You know, I got pushed a little bit, boo-hoo. So adults may not be quite that bad, but still, you do find that kind of thing. And, you know, it's when you've got evil people doing evil things, whether they're small or whether they're big, it can be very, very difficult. He says, too, no doubt this noble soldier's bed swam with tears, which we talked about last time many a time, because of other sins. He goes on to say this in Philippians 3, verses 17 through 19. As these verses are read in just a minute, think about the fact that here are some people who are religious people as far as the behavior that's being described. And it is a bad, bad thing. Philippians 3, 17 and 19.
Brethren, be ye imitators together of me, and mark them that so walk, even as ye have us for an example. For many walk, of whom I told you often, and now tell you even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is perdition, whose God is the belly, and whose glory is in their shame, who mind earthly things.
Okay, Paul, as he talks about these people, says they walk, and how many of them, he says, walk this way?
Many.
He's thus referring to several people, and he said, I've told you about these individuals how often? Often. Frequently. It's a topic that has been discussed many, many times. And he says, now, there are these many people. I've told you about this often. I'm telling you about this again, but this time I'm telling you with weeping. I'm telling you this with tears. This is a matter of great distress for me. Rather than being friends of the Lord, they are his enemies. And he goes on to say their end is going to be destruction. Paul didn't take any joy in this. And he also said the God is their belly. That is kind of like, you know, their appetite. That's what they want. And the glory is their shame. They mind earthly things. So this was distressing. Is it distressing for you? I was thinking about this the other day, not really because of this lesson, but other circumstances. I drove by a neighborhood. And every time I drive by, it's within about 7 miles of here. Every time I drive by that neighborhood, I might struggle to find the house again. But I think about how we had a campaign here a few years ago. And a lady and I went through that neighborhood. And I think there was another couple that was working with us. And we knocked on doors. And we knocked on the door of someone who was a driver for FedEx. And this fellow and his family said, "We're interested in studying the Bible." So we went out there a few times. And the fellow's work schedule and life schedule were difficult enough to, you know, hardly have any time with them at all. He just said, "I really don't have any extra time." So we said, "We will make ourselves available to you. If you want us to come shortly before you go to work, if you want us to come right after you come to work, you tell us what works best for you." And I can still remember going to this fellow's house on various occasions, and he was tired because of the work schedule. So, I mean, I can understand that. And there were some occasions where it just felt like he was going to go to sleep on us. But we got to a time where he said, "You know, I'm sure this is important, but for me, I've just got so much going on, I'm just going to have to get back to it at a later time." Kind of like what we see in the book of Acts. Remember, at a more convenient time, we'll get back and talk about these things. Well, if that convenient time ever came for this man, I'm unaware of it. And maybe he's dead, maybe he's moved on, maybe he's doing the same job. I'm not sure what exactly his situation is. But every time I drive by that road and see that neighborhood, I think about that man and the family. And that's sad. So here's a fellow who apparently had a good heart, but sometimes you have evil people and you see what they're doing and it really is sad. Okay, before we pick up with the next reference, anything that you want to add or ask? Okay, this is going to come from 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 26 in just a minute. He says, "Before that, because of many perils in traveling in those days." If you were traveling in the first century like Paul, what would some of the perils have been? Well, what's a peril? Let's look at that verse. What's a peril?
Adversary.
All right, it could be an adversary. It could be
a problem along the way, some trouble or something.
All right, there's some kind of danger. There's something that's going to interfere with your trip. There's some potential difficulty. What would some of those difficulties have been for Paul and other travelers? Dangers or problems?
It might have been dangers along the road. People to rob him.
Okay.
People to beat him up.
Jesus, the road to Jericho. You know, he makes it clear in that teaching that you do have robbers in that day. In the Sermon on the Mount, he talked about people breaking in and stealing. So you have some examples in the Old Testament, too, of theft. So that certainly was a common problem. What else? Perils, if you're going to travel.
Weather.
All right. You know, we've got things like raincoats today. Or you can get inside the vehicle. Even if it's Amish buggy, you've still got some protection. But if you're out there walking, unless you're on a ship where you can get inside, the degree of protection is probably going to be pretty limited. So, you know, if it's cold, you could freeze to death. Rain, it's certainly going to be unpleasant, muddy, and likely don't have a set of spare clothes. What else? Perils.
Right? Where are you going to get food?
All right, yeah. You know, there's not going to be a convenience store somewhere along the way. So you can pack a certain amount of food, but maybe buy some or maybe bake some. But even that basic item is going to be hard to come by. What about medical attention? We think it's bad. You're going down the interstate and a kidney stone attack comes. Oh, where's the next hospital? An hour away, I'm going to die. Well, we might feel like that, but can you imagine what it would have been like in the first century? I mean, you're out there on a road and you have really no transportation, there's no doc, there's no medical attention, there's no cell phone to say call out the helicopter or bring you. So you have many, many perils. Even 150 years ago, if you were traveling, you decided that you were in the east and you'd heard stories about how great the west is, so you decide that you are going to head out to California and do some gold prospecting, or you're up in Boston and you're going to come over here to the Midwest somewhere and see what Ohio is like or one of the other Midwestern states. What would some of the perils have been?
Mountains and rivers.
All right. You have natural boundaries that are going to cause some problems. You're going to have rivers. You're going to have mountains, hills. What else? All right. You're going to have to deal with various predators. Maybe a rattlesnake out there. You know, it may not be the bear, it may not be the cougar. You know, something as small as a snake may kill you or at least do some serious... I mean, people die from snake bites today?
Yeah.
They do. So you can imagine with our technology, going back 150 years or so, what it was like. What else? Perils.
He had some in the cities that he...
All right. And if you go back 100, 150 years, maybe the law is not the best or the law is corrupt. And if you... can't get along with the folks there, or maybe there is no law. So you have lawlessness, those kinds of things. So it's pretty good from our day and time, but when we look at those days, it was very, very difficult. It's literally true that they had several perils. So, he says, any departure to other parts of the country could mean the end of a treasured relationship. That is absolutely right. So, today, it's sometimes painful or difficult to say goodbye to someone. Anybody ever had to do that with their kids? Child reached 18, 19, 20, and you felt like you had to say goodbye? All right, one, college, two, three, four. At least a few of us have gone down that. And that may not be as difficult as for the husband, as the wife. But when you feel like your child is going to move four or five states away, or be 12 hours away, or 24 hours away, or headed into the military, maybe being sent overseas somewhere, or any place other than right down the road, you know, you can feel like, hey, this is goodbye, and I'm hoping that I'm going to see you again sometime soon. So Paul has a lot of those things going on in his life. 2 Corinthians 11:26. Julie? Okay. He had perils on every side. Some of them were objects, like Brian mentioned. You've got rivers and mountains and hills. There were people who wanted to do him evil or harm, like the robbers. There were religious people who were not interested in what he was trying to do. So all kinds of issues. And at the top of page 45, you there have the reference to false brethren. Hence, or therefore, when any evangelist or other valuable worker in the church left to fulfill a duty to take the gospel to others, he just might not have the opportunity to return. That's exactly right. And today there are some cases where that is also true. People kind of look at things and say, we're not sure he's going to come back. You know, we're not sure that she's going to ever be someone that we get to see again. So serious stuff, especially in that day and time, but still has some application today. Anything that you want to discuss before we pick up with our next passages? Okay. We have here some information from Acts chapter 20. This will be verses 36 to 38. And then if you read that, we'll also ask you to move into the next chapter, Acts chapter 21, verse 13. Who'd like to read from Acts chapter 20? Brian, let's start with verse 36 and read through 38.
And when he had thus spoken, he kneeled down and prayed with them all. And they all wept sore and fell on Paul's neck and kissed him, sorrowing most of all for the words which he spake, that they should see his face no more. And they accompanied him to the ship.
Okay, Paul is in Miletus. While he's there, he calls to the elders from Ephesus. Now remember, Ephesus is a congregation in the New Testament that we know hardly anything about. We know some about it. Or, compared to most of the congregations that are talked about, we know quite a bit about Ephesus. Which of the three would be right? We know nothing, or little, or almost nothing. Some, or quite a bit, compared to others.
At least some. Maybe more.
Yeah, we know her. I mean, we've got a letter to the congregation at Ephesus. We've got Acts chapter 20. We've got a book known as Ephesians. So when you take just those three things, this is a congregation that's, you know, featured, if you will, in many ways. So you have here the elders of this congregation, and Paul says, look, I want you to think back. I want you to give consideration to what we've discussed, the time that I had among you. I did not hold anything back that was useful or profitable. And we've had some good times together. But now he says, things are going to change. Where am I going to go? I'm going to go to the city of Jerusalem. And what's going to happen when I get down to Jerusalem? All right. I'm going to endure some affliction. I'm going to be bound. And you're not going to see my face anymore. Now, that's what's going to happen to me. But here at Ephesus, let's talk about what's going to happen to you. He says, people are going to come from, you know, among your own selves, that is from within the eldership. And he said, they're going to speak what kinds of things? Perverse things. For what purpose? To draw away disciples after them. So this was apostasy that Paul was predicting. So he, in view of all these things, he kneels down and he does what? Prays with them all. And they wept sore. They fell on Paul's neck and they kissed him. Then filling in that next blank too, sorrowing most of all for the words which he spake, that they should see his face no more. There are some times where we say goodbye to somebody, and maybe we're not sure about the future, or maybe we're pretty sure that we're never going to see them again. Anybody ever had that? You developed a friendship with somebody, and when you said goodbye, you figured, I'm probably not going to see you again in this life. All right, if you spent any time in the military, you can probably, if you've spent any time on a foreign field, or maybe it was a college experience where you had access to some people and they were in a different curriculum, they were looking for a different degree or a different diploma, those kinds of things. So that happens, and that's what Paul was describing here. Brian, if you will, across the page, next chapter, Acts chapter 21, let's look at verse 13.
Then Paul answered, what mean ye to weep and to break my heart? For I am ready not only to be bound, but also to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus.
Okay. I also want to pick up a complimentary reference here. And we'll have a couple minutes to get that as we talk about what Brian just read. But 2 Samuel chapter 12, verses 19 through 23. 2 Samuel 12, 19 to 23. Somebody want to turn back there too? 2 Samuel 12, 19 to 23. Okay, Julie, get that. Let's start with Acts chapter 21, verse 13. We have this prophet by the name of Agabus, and he says, Paul, you're going to go to Jerusalem. And when you're in the city of Jerusalem, you're going to be bound. Well, the disciples, Paul's friends, hear that, and what's their reaction? Hey, Paul, go. No, they
wanted him to stay.
All right, avoid that. Don't put yourself in that position. We want you to stay. Paul's reply, his response to that, is this. What mean ye to weep and to break mine heart? For I'm ready to not only be bound, but also to die in Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. Now this is going to line up well with our next reference. But when it comes to tears, is it not true that there needs to come a time, and I'm not saying that this is going to permanently stop the tears, but where the grieving process has to reach a point where you say, you know, I need to, you know, put this in the right spot. I can't let it control my life as it's been doing for the last, you know, days, weeks, months, year or so plus. Don't we need to do that? Yes. I mean, tears are right. Grief is right. All those things are helpful. But we hear sometimes people who are stuck in the state of grief. You know, they are just so overburdened by grief. You know, it's 40 years later and they're still trying to deal with some things. That's not healthy. Now, nothing wrong with continuing to grieve and having some sorrowful moments and thinking, I sure wish this would not have happened or this set of circumstances had gone differently. And you see David exemplifying this in 2 Samuel 12, 19 to 23. Now this is a pretty dramatic shift as you look at David. I mean, he's broken up with grief. He is in a state of almost depression. And it is, you know, all out weeping, all out mourning. And then after a brief period of time, what happens? He gets up. Time to eat. Time to live again. Well, I'm not sure that people, for the most part today, are going to turn that quickly. Because, I mean, that seems, even the servants, as you look at 2 Samuel chapter 12, they seemed a little surprised. And you see that in what Julie read as far as being here one day, and then, you know, not long after that, he's over here getting ready and heading back to life. So I would not use this as far as a model today. If someone has lost a person that they love, lost a child, and say, well, okay, you know, you've had a few days, everything should be fine. I would not count that as a valid use of the account. But I would make this point that David did recognize that there is that state of grief, but a time does come. You think he still missed that child at times? Sure. But once again, he said, I recognize in my life that death is not going to control my life forever. there comes a time where we do have to start putting the pieces back together. And you have that, I think, with Paul in Acts chapter 21, verse 13. He says, "What mean ye to weep and break my heart?" The decision has been made. These are the facts. I may not like them, you may not like them, but this is the way that things are, and we simply have to stand up and face the consequences and do what's correct here. Do you think that's a helpful lesson in life as we deal with people? It is. So try not to put a person on the clock and say, well, you had this amount of time and you should be over it and things should be a lot better. But this is something that we can, I think, help people with. Before we deal with the next section, anything that you want to add or ask? Okay. Next section is entitled, Because of the Suffering of Loved Ones. This takes us back to the book of Nehemiah, chapter 1. We'll look at verses 3 and 4 and look at those individually. And then we will turn over to the book of Esther and look at Esther chapter 4, verse 1. Who wants to be headed towards Nehemiah? The first chapter. Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. All right, Lois. And after we read from Nehemiah 1, as I said, we'll look at the fourth chapter of Esther. Who wants to read for us Esther 4, the first verse? Esther 4, verse 1. Betty? Okay, let's go back to Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 1. Verse 3, the context is you have some of Nehemiah's brethren. They come, they pay a visit to him, and they say, look, here is the situation. That information is given to Nehemiah. Let's pick up with verse 3. Lois?
And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who used to survive the captivity are in great distress and reproach. And the wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are burned with fire.
Okay, let's fill in our blanks and then think about what's being said. The remnant, the leftover people that are left in captivity, they're in the province. They're in great affliction. They're also in a state of reproach. And there is the wall of Jerusalem, which is broken down. And not only is the wall broken down, you also have a problem with the gates. They've been burned with fire. When we think about bad news, if someone is going to deliver somebody bad news today, what would you classify as bad news being given to somebody? Somebody says, I've got some news for you. Sit down, it's not good. What kind of news would fall into that category? All right, the doc comes and says the test results are in, and this is what you have. There is no cure, or this is going to greatly restrict your life. That would be a great answer. What else? Bad news.
Yeah.
All right, there is that notification. You're not expecting it. It's sudden, and someone shows up at the door or maybe makes a telephone call and says, I'm sorry, but someone has that you seem to know is no longer with us. All right, so we've got health. We've got life and death. What else? Bad news. Really bad news. All right, where plant's going to close, you lost your job, or there's something else where maybe not everybody's going to be released, but you're going to be fired. Today's your last day. Pack up your belongings and go home. What else? Bad news.
I'm on vacation, and I just got word that my house burned back.
Okay, and maybe halfway across the country, and a neighbor calls and says, I have some really bad news for you. Well, that's the kind of news, for us, I think if we had the church building burned down here. That's bad news, but we probably wouldn't count that in the same way because we can work out something else, can't we? Couldn't we probably rent a hall? And I mean, we would feel, okay, we're going to be, a few steps behind compared to what we're typically able to do, but I mean, this is not the end of the world. But if you're halfway across the country in another part of the world and you get that, it's kind of like, I've got my hands full over here. What am I going to do? So when you have here Jerusalem, this is the capital city. This is the place where if you were going to go home, I mean, this was it. And the word is brought. It's burned. It's gone. The walls are knocked down. The gates have been burned with fire. And it's just this state of great distress. So if we look at it in a religious context for us, as far as the building being lost, I don't think we really get anything close to that. But if we can compare it to the kinds of things that we talked about, the death, the sickness, the house burning down while we're way out of town, those kinds of things, then this was the type of news that was being communicated. All right, verse 4.
Now it came about when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven.
Okay, let's list what he did and then once again make a parallel to it. He first of all sits down. That's often what we tell somebody when we have bad news. Doctor comes out of the surgical area and he says, let's sit down. Well, sometimes it's just, let's sit down and talk. You know, I've been on my feet for a little while. But oftentimes with the tone of voice, with the look on the face, you instantly know that this is not a good report. So you mentally start preparing yourself for bad news. All right, so he sits down and then he wept for how long?
7 days.
All right, so he's got more than one day. There are multiple days. He's weeping. He also fasts, so he's not eating. You have, in addition to the things that we talked about now with this description from the Bible, think about it in terms of this time of year. Tornado rips through town, and you head off. You know, maybe you're out of town a little bit. You get to the tornado shelter, and you hear on the radio that 50 houses have been damaged. And they mention the street, and you're thinking, uh-oh, I live on that street. Maybe there's a quick camera shot, and you can see that there's a lot of devastation down there, but you know, your house, you can't really get a good picture of it. And you go back, and you find out that your house has been, I mean, literally whisked away. Everything that you have is either in part of a rubble pile, or it's, you know, who knows where, or blasted to smithereens. At that moment, as you're standing there, the only thing that you have left is a driveway. If you've got a slab house, the only thing you have there, some concrete, and you've got, you know, pipes sticking up for, you know, various things that were part of the house. What might be one of the first things that you do? All right. I think that's probably going to be one of the things. But anything maybe even prior to that? Almost in shock. It's just, I can't believe it. You know, an hour ago, my house was here. Everything was great. It was locked up. No difficulties. You know, maybe it was a newer house, or maybe you've gone through and renovated the house, and everything was fine. And now, look at it. It is completely gone. So you have there the shock, maybe the falling on the ground, maybe just sitting down and saying, I need to get my breath. And then you find people starting to literally bawl because their life has just been turned upside down, and they feel like, you know, they're never going to be able to recover or recover fully. So that's what I would try to express as we're looking at what is taking place here with Nehemiah. The next point, just at the bottom of 45, Nehemiah could not be happy while his people were being held in bondage. So he secured permission from the king to go and help his people. The king could see that he was upset, and the king was willing to aid in rebuilding things. All right, now let's flip over to the book of Esther and take a look at that fourth chapter. We talked about Esther not too long ago, Haman, Mordecai. Haman, of course, was the evil man who wanted all the Jewish people to be killed, and Mordecai would not bow down to him, so he thought, I'm going to fix him. Gallows were built and didn't go quite according to Haman's plan. Esther 4, verse 1. Okay, here's Mordecai's reaction to the decree. He did what with his clothing?
Rent
or tore his clothes. He put on sackcloth, and that also was accompanied with ashes. And he goes out and cries how?
Loud,
bitter cry. Now, I'm not sure why, but in our culture, maybe you've had some different experiences, but I typically don't hear loud, bitter cries. Anybody hear those? You know, people will cry and maybe cry a lot, but when I think of loud and bitter, it's almost in the shrieking category, if my understanding of it is correct.
Yeah. I just remember one moment, one time, when a death of a family member, I don't remember if it was a child or a husband or whatever, but she just cried and groaned and moaned so loud.
Mm-hmm. Well, that does bring to mind an additional point. I was going to make a point before that, but let me reverse them. Something like 9/11. When you go there and when you're exposed to the devastation, it's not just your loss. But, you know, you're just tying it in with the overwhelming massive, and you're thinking, wow, what did they suffer? What did they experience? What was it like? The tragedy is just overwhelming. So there you can have some shrieking. If you look at some of the earthquakes, the mudslides, the volcanoes, there you do find that loud, that shrieking once again. And maybe part of that is because the environment is a lot less controlled. I mean, if it's just you, you've got some people around to console you and help you, but when you just see that death and destruction around you, it just almost seems to magnify it. When I think about shrieking, anybody ever stepped on a cat's tail or a dog's tail or the paw?
Shut one
of the car doors. Well, I've not done that. But there, I think you're probably going to get the shrieking. You know, sure, you know, that kind of thing. So there is that reaction as well, that this is a big deal. You know, my tail is caught in the car door, or, you know, you've stepped on it and please let it go, those kinds of things. So it's not just with human beings. You also find with animals that they have that capacity to cry out and say, this is very, very bad. A little more, and then we'll see if there's anything that you'd like to add or ask. Fortunately, as we've already seen, Esther was able to influence the king, and the decree was reversed. Thoughts that you want to contribute before we pick up with frustration, discouragement, and rejection? Right?
When I think of the moment going in, I think of the children in Bethlehem at the time of Christ. Egyptians, night of the Passover, when the Israelites were leaving, they could hear all that moment and see the people busy burying the dead.
Yeah. You wonder a little bit about with, it wasn't a death angel. We don't have that term used in the Bible. It's the word destroyer, which we're not sure exactly what that means, but there was some force. Whether it was an angel or what it was, but there was something that came and took those lives. But you wonder a little bit, at least I do, how did that work? You know, it's around midnight, so you would think that maybe there were a lot of people who were probably in bed or close to bed. But, you know, here's a mother maybe nursing her baby, or, you know, maybe the, you know, family's going to bed late at night. And how do they die? Is it just he or she, you know, the child drops over? Is there a change in the appearance? I mean, how do you begin to piece that together? But surely the news passed fairly quickly. My child, my firstborn, is dead. Well, mine is too. And again, you kind of get back to the 9/11 grief, where it is almost a corporate grief, where it almost feeds on itself. What was the other one you mentioned? Oh, Bethlehem. Yeah, Matthew describes that, where that's kind of a different set of circumstances. But if you can imagine something like, even today, like ISIS, they're going door to door looking for certain people. And once they find you, they don't care who's in the room. They don't care who's in the house. But if it's a dad, if it's a child, if it's a mom, let's just go ahead and execute you. And maybe other family members get to see it. Now there again, that would be so, it's one thing to get news of a death. But to actually watch a loved one, maybe a child, executed in front of you. You know, we've got that, wasn't it Zedekiah? Son's killed and then his eyes are put out. That was going to be the last thing that he saw. And that's just absolutely brutal. But people have been doing that at various times. And the image from that, the pain from that, it just seems to magnify it. Brent?
I think in our history, the Civil War had some wars where tens of thousands of people died in a day. They organized their companies geographically. So there were some communities where every man died in one day.
Yeah.
And for those communities, it was a really big deal.
Yeah. And you can imagine the women coming together. You get back to that magnified grief. You know, what am I going to do? I've lost everything. And, you know, it's very, very difficult. So you have in recent times, historical times, and certainly in the Bible, these kinds of things. Anybody else that we overlooked? Okay. Discouragement, rejection, frustration. He goes back here to Genesis chapter 21, verse 9. This is, of course, the time we have the feast. Abraham gave that. That was the day that Isaac was weaned. Verse 9 says, Sarah saw the son of Hagar. That would have been Ishmael. And he was mocking, making fun of Sarah's son. And Sarah told Abraham to cast out the boy and his mom. Abraham was upset by that, very disturbed. But God said, listen to who? Listen to your wife. Do what Sarah has asked, and that is what he did. God said, it's going to be okay. I'm going to make a great nation of Ishmael. So you've got Hagar, you've got her son, they're cast out. They end up out there in the wilderness, and things are not looking too good for Hagar. At least that's what's going through her mind. They've got the water bottle for a little while, and then that's consumed. So she takes Ishmael, puts him where? Under a bush. What's her thinking at that point? All right, you know, we're going to die. We're out here, and, you know, it's the same kind of thing. It takes us kind of back to the ISIS comment. You know, if you see it, it's going to be bad. But, I mean, there are ways that you can make something worse or more intense, and that seems to be what she was doing. So he's not that far away, a bow shot away, so still reasonably close. And then you get down to the latter part of verse 16. It says, and she said over against him, And she lifted up her voice and she wept. She cried. A paraphrase of that would say she burst into tears, which I think that's probably, if that's not a very good rendering of the Hebrew text, at least that's probably a pretty good way of describing how she felt. It was just like, I'm being overwhelmed. You also have, when we think about death, the death of people who are loved ones. Mary and Martha at the death of Lazarus, John chapter 11, you have there many people, friends, loved ones coming to share in the sorrow. But who else was touched by the family's loss? Jesus. So when you think about God, many times a person who's going through great sorrow will say, well, nobody can understand. Well, that's probably not literally true. Are we the first one to have lost someone that we love? No. Other people that we know have gone through the same process. Maybe it was a little easier for them. Maybe it was harder for them. Maybe all things are somewhat equal. But the Lord can certainly understand. Then we have back in Genesis chapter 23, verse 2, Sarah's death there in the land of Canaan. The Bible says, and Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. So you have that. Obviously, typically there is mourning. There is grieving, weeping at the time of someone's death. As time passes, there's still going to be some of that. You have to, and people are going to vary a little on this for various reasons, I suppose. But there's some that will want to go out to a cemetery, and I've known of people who wanted to go out there and sit by the grave. Maybe they've wanted to go out and pray at the gravesite. Maybe they've wanted to go out and have a one-sided conversation with a person that they've lost. People have done all kinds of things, or maybe just drive out to the gravesite and sit in the car because they feel a little closer to a loved one. Maybe that's done on a special occasion. Maybe after loss has occurred, they're going to go out and do that on a fairly regular basis. You might have some people that do that daily for a while, or they do it weekly or monthly. So all of that just kind of varies a little bit from person to person. But you have here back in Genesis chapter 23, Abraham going through, at least in some respects, that same kind of process. So it's kind of interesting that you find that reference early in the Bible. Then in Deuteronomy chapter 34, verses 7 and 8, we learn about Moses. He was how old when he died? 120. That's an easy number to remember. And at that time, his what was not dim? All right, his sight was still good. His natural force had not abated. And then we find something that kind of ties in with the preceding point. The children of Israel did weep for Moses how long? 30 days. And it says at the end, so the days of weeping and mourning for Moses were ended. I find a couple of things interesting about that. Today, if there is, and we've not seen this, the last one I think was probably Reagan. Didn't Tip O'Neill die not too long ago? Speaker of the House way back when. Wasn't there a big deal with the funeral within the last couple of years? There was somebody that was not a president.
I think the living presidents showed up.
Yeah. But anyway, we know Reagan. And they had apparently planned that out well in advance. Nancy had made a pretty elaborate plan. So whether you liked the guy or hated the guy, you have there a lot of people. And interestingly, some of them were news folks that didn't like Reagan. Said all kinds of bad things about him when he was alive. But he dies, and now all of a sudden, good things are said by him. But when you have someone who is really, really prominent, it almost seems like time stops for a little bit. And a president would be a good example of that. I don't know that I can cite anything that, in my mind, equals Moses. I mean, 30 days of mourning is a long time. Now, if you had some religious leader, like the Catholic Pope die, it would be interesting to see.
I remember Princess Diana, but she died.
Okay, yes.
That was a big deal for a couple weeks.
Yes. So that would be probably one of the better examples that we could come up with as far as a modern death. But there is just that ongoing outpouring. People will show up, stand in line for hours to get some glimpse of the funeral, or come up with flowers or something else to lay at the makeshift memorial. So people can do that, but in the case of Moses, you have here a whole month of weeping for him. And, he was a very influential man. So leaders can have a huge impact on a culture when it's time to mourn. Any other thoughts on that before we pick up with the next item? Okay, this is point 4 from Acts chapter 9. We have some information about Dorcas. She, a Christian, she became sick and she died. They sent for Peter. He arrives. Acts 9:39 says, when the widows were doing what? Weeping and showing the coats and garments as she made Peter raise her from the dead. you have sometimes in the Bible some snapshots of human nature, and this is one of the places where I would say we have a snapshot. When you have someone who dies, is it fairly common for them to do what we find here with Dorcas? They go back and they start remembering what kinds of things?
All the good things.
Yes. You know, this is my shawl, and it came from her. You know, Joe helped me with the project out there in the back 40, those kinds of things. People remember those items. And here, there were some positive memories that had been created by this Christian sister, and Peter found himself in a position where ladies were sharing some of those memories. Look at the coats that she made. And then, of course, she's raised from the dead. Point five, in the seventh chapter of Acts, we have the story of about a Christian being stoned to death for preaching the gospel. This, of course, was Stephen. Acts 8:2 says there were devout men who carried his body to the burial spot and made great what?
Lamentation
over him. Here again, in my mind, you have a snapshot, maybe not the clearest, but you have a picture of human nature. If you have ever gone to a graveside and you have either experienced this personally, or maybe you were not all that connected to the family, but you know, maybe a couple friends, you went for them, you find typically at a funeral home there's a lot of weeping there, and then maybe it kind of calms down, quiets a little bit, head out to the graveside, and then what do you find again out there? All right, there's another round. And you almost get that impression with Stephen in the book of Acts, that, you know, maybe they've had something like a service, or they've had some words, and now even as they're on their way out to the graveside, there's still that sense of loss. So even for a Christian, there are tears. But remember what Paul told the Thessalonians. He said, sorrow not as those who have no hope. So there is the sorrow that Christians should have. And Paul says that should not be to the same degree as a non-Christian, because the non-Christian has no hope whatsoever. So we don't want to find ourselves in that spot. But still, sorrow is right. And, you know, some people are going to cry more than others. And God doesn't say, well, this is the exact amount that's right, and this is too much, and so forth. So it is an individual thing, and sometimes you do find it in both locations. Anything you want to ask before we pick up with point six? Okay. David, we have here some information about his son Absalom, a wicked son. He'd been killed, and now you have David, oh, my son, Absalom, would God I had died for thee, oh, Absalom, my son, my son. 2 Samuel chapter 18, verse 33. There are times where people are just overcome with grief. And I had a point marked in my lesson book earlier that I didn't make. But, you know, grief is an interesting thing. Because at the end of the day, after people have gone through it, and the dust has settled a little bit, it could have a third reaction. But oftentimes, the people that have dealt with the griever are looked at in one of two ways. Positively is one possibility, and negatively would be another possibility. What would the positive item be? As far as you've lost someone and a person who had contact with you, you now look at them in a more positive way. What would cause that? All right, they helped you. They were there. Maybe they brought food. Maybe they talked to you. Maybe they invited you to spend the night over at their house for, you know, at least a night. They've reached out to you and tried to support you. Do you think it might be that there are some other folks who, after losing someone, have a lot of negative emotions stirred up in their life? Before, you may not have been close, or you may have been very close, but now it's almost like you're on the top 10 list when it comes to enemies. Think people can react to you like that because of grief?
I think so. And sometimes they will blame you that you couldn't do anything more for them.
A doctor. For example, doctor may say, I think we've got hope here. I'm pretty sure I can fix the problem. It doesn't work out well. And, you know, the person is upset. I don't know that I've told you this before. Maybe a few people know, but I preached a sermon for a family that I had some moderate connections to. And in that lesson, I talked about Hades, where people go after they die. There's two sections in Hades. There's a positive side and there's a negative side. Well, I'm not sure that all the family members had good hearing that day. Maybe I spoke too softly, too loudly. Maybe the grief was too great. But this lady, she was a Christian, the deceased. And yet I still remember to this day that one of the family members, a fellow who was not very religious, and I'm sure broken up with grief because it was his mom, he concluded that I preached his mom into hell. And to this day, if he's still alive, I'm pretty sure he's not forgiven me. Now, you know, sometimes good intentions don't always work out for the best. You try to be helpful to people, and it doesn't work out always well. So when you think about David and Absalom, this really strong reaction, sometimes you're going to get that from people who have just lost someone. They're going to feel like you've really helped them, or they're going to feel like somehow you have done something, said something to really hurt them, and that's going to alter your relationship for a long time, maybe forever. Now, having said that, should you then be fearful about trying to help people if they've lost someone? No. I mean, we're trying to do the best that we can. And I think most people, most reasonable people, are able to conclude that. So we might get some things wrong. Hopefully we get more right than we do wrong. But do be mindful of the fact that when people are really in a state of great distress, they may perceive some of the things that we say, some of the things that we do, some of the help that we try to offer, they may not perceive that in the same way that we're trying to extend it. And that can be true of just about anything in life, but especially when it comes to grief.